executive branch has largely remained fairly responsive. I think that there's been the development of a tradition, if you will, in rural Alaska, certainly, about demanding accountability and response directly from legislators and governors. Having served on the Policy Review Commission, I've had the opportunity of talking with members of other Indian tribes who have worked through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or they've worked through other layers of government. But we in Alaska have always felt that we ought to have access directly to our legislators and directly to our governor. Part of it is because we're a relatively small community. I think it has worked fairly well and is subject to variations, as is any humanly run institution. Occasionally, there is a concern when a group meets with a particular department, is the response a representative of that, the actual policy of the chief executive? I would conclude by saying I feel a sense of optimism. I feel a sense of appreciation for the extent, nature, quality of the deliberations that went into the development of our Constitution. And I feel that there's we are still working for statehood, but this time for the continuation of a successful statehood. And John and other delegates, I think you've given us the catalyst for being able to do the job. And I appreciate the opportunity to at least share my views such as they are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. That was excellent.
Can I ask a question that's unrelated to this board, maybe? But we have a legislator here and a representative of the executive branch, and I'd very much like to know. One thing we did not envision at the Constitutional Convention was the domination by the Finance Committee of the legislature. And I think I've stated it correctly. We never envisioned this. Criticism takes many forms. The most common is that the legislature lasts too long. Well, that is not the fault of the legislature, as I see it. It's the fault of the damn fool Finance Committee that waits until the last day, brings out a bill full of trades and bargains and whatnot. The legislators are ready to go home. They're anxious to go home. They pass it without hardly reading it. Many people have criticized this. I don't think that putting a duration on the session is going to cure it. But I think we've got to do something to prevent the secret meetings of the Finance Committee, to prevent a deplorable practice that has grown up. They put notes on the bills addressed to the department heads. They're super secret. They can't get a copy of them. I've been trying for years, but they exist, but I can't get copies of them. They say, unless you fire somebody, unless you hire somebody, unless you do this or that, you're not going to get an appropriation next year. And we've developed a government within a government that's taking advantage of the people because of the powers that they are abusing. And I think, damn it, we ought to do something about it.
We did.
What?
With all of the intent of the Finance Committee is available, not only available, but in the chamber. At the time the Pre-Commerce Committee report on the budget is voted on. We started that in 1975. There's obviously going to be litigation over the question of the legality, the binding effect of legislative intent. In order that there won't be any procedural question about whether it was available to legislators or not.
I'm not talking about intent.
Well, you were talking about any secret intent. What I'm saying is there is no such thing, hasn't been the last 2 years, a secret intent. With regard to the
secret intent is when the legislator comes and tells the member of the executive branch.
No, they put it in writing, and it isn't intent.
It's
a direction to the department.
Well, but that doesn't have any more effect than the legislator's power. With regard to the Finance Committee waiting until the last moment, that simply didn't happen either. In fact, in the last session of the legislature, we asked the Finance Committee to not meet the Pre-Commerce Committee on the budget for more than 1 week, simply to let the legislature catch up with the Finance Committee, and they did not. You'll recall that during this past session...
No, they were passing bills about homosexuality.
No, that didn't pass either, John. In fact, the only thing you got to the floor. The Pre-Commerce Committee on the budget simply didn't meet for more than a week in order to give the legislature time to catch up.
Well, that was the first time that ever happened, John.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't president before, so I'm not going to take responsibility.
Yeah, that's what other members.
I've only seen one time that the Finance Committee has, in effect, held the legislative session up. And that time, the respective body had the power to do something about it, but failed to do it. So the legislature has within its power the ability to cope with the problem, and usually does. But, you know, the myth that the Finance Committee is holding up the
session. It's no myth at all. I was there for 4 years, and I know damn well they did.
In my 4 years, it
was
a myth.
They did it deliberately.
With the exception of one, and at one time, the House had the power or the authority to do something about it and simply chose not to. But I think in the last 2 years, it has not been a problem. The Finance Committee was not the reason that the session was held up. Obviously, it's a very complicated situation. You know, there's something like close to 2,000 bills that are introduced in the legislature as a total. So when you're dealing with those numbers, that vast quantity of bills, and try to determine what's going to pass and what's not going to pass, it takes a lot of time. And I'll tell you, it's not the budget that holds it up. It's the complexity of the situation.
Moderator, I think we're finally made the point of where we're wandering somewhat off the subject, aren't we?
I think this is a very pressing thing. We finished our executive branch, but I think we should be aware of it. And somebody better do something about it.
I think it's about time that we let a few people in the audience get us back to the executive branch.
Can I get a piece of that argument?
I just want to say that unicameralism will solve the problems of the joint Congress.
The solution would probably be the California system, where every other year they meet as a committee of the whole and do nothing but an appropriation bill. No other general legislation can be introduced. This does away with the log rolling that I'll vote for your rotten bill if you'll vote for my rotten bill. You know, this trading they do. It does away with that. It has a good tendency to do away with it. And I think we should give a damn serious thought in Alaska, because the people are suffering because of this wheeling and dealing in that damn Finance Committee.
Is there anybody out there who would like to get in on this break?
I'm Jack Boswell, member of the Executive Committee delegate. One thing that somebody brought up, I wouldn't remember who, was the election of the lieutenant governor. Now, in our estimation, the main point there was be sure he would be the same party as a governor. If he could be a Republican, the other could be a Democrat. And so if he had to take over, everything would be fouled up. And that's all I had to say.
To the extent that that was the concern, obviously the constitutional provision takes care of that.
Sure.
Say, if one of the things that has occurred in the meantime, though, has been the decline of the significance of party government in Alaska. It was much more important then than it is now. I mean, within any one party, you've got the whole spectrum of political beliefs. So having somebody of the same party by no means guarantees any party discipline or any philosophy similarity.
Well, I've been away for 10 years, and we have lots of problems in Oregon in the same way.
Anybody else?
May I? I would like to ask.
Would you use the mic?
Oh, we have to go up there.
Right.
We're sharing this with everyone in Alaska.
Oh!
Okay. And identify yourself.
Well, I have been sort of watching this proliferation of boards, advisory boards, commissions, and so forth, and sort of blaming the governor, because it seemed to me that it was an abdication of his executive responsibility. I'm not sure, maybe it is the legislature that sets them up by law, and then the governor makes the appointments. But in the original, when we were starting to write the executive article, we were all very conscious of the fact that under the territorial government, we couldn't do anything, so we had boards and commissions. And the hope was that with a strong executive, that much of that would be eliminated. It would be a savings in some respects, and then the governor would have, would work through his cabinet members, and then they would take the place of all these boards and commissions. I welcome your comments.
Well, I think that, you know, going back to statehood, there's certainly been examples of all governors introducing legislation that would create a new board. There's been some of that done by the legislature as well, but I'm not sure, at least without going back and looking at some detail, that just offhand you can say there's a pattern that governors have been doing it or that legislators have been doing it, but the most, but at least governors have been doing it. I do think, though, it indicates some desire on the governor's part to try and share authority in it. And I think there's no question but what we've seen that the greatest increase in the number of advisory boards and commissions and the like in the past 2 years. And to some extent, I think it's a mistake for the governor to get into that area because, frankly, the setting of policy, at least in theory, is a legislative function, and the legislature should be doing that type of thing through its process. Maybe somebody will feel that the legislature hasn't been doing it, and that's why the governor has. But I would think to the extent that the governor has gotten into the policy question, it's taken away from his executive ability and his administration of the laws that already exist, and so that he's done that at some sacrifice to the efficient operation of the state in that regard.
To a certain degree, I think it's unfair to characterize this administration as being more reliant on boards and commissions than that of past administrations. When I first came on as commissioner administration, I counted the number of boards and commissions we had, and they exceeded the number of 100 by a substantial number. And, you know, Governor Hammond has added a few boards and commissions, but they're in areas that he wanted more public input. And he has a very, you might say he has less reliance on some of these past boards and commissions. He doesn't use them, but they are in effect there by statute. So they're there by statute, and you appoint the members to them. But I think I have to agree with Senator Croft. When you start relying on the advice of boards and commissions, you are, in a sense, relinquishing the responsibility that you have in that area. And sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's bad. And I think you have to look at the particular situation to be able to tell whether it is or whether it isn't. And naturally, one person would think it is, and you might have another one that isn't. But, you know, I personally feel that we have far too many boards and commissions. We could do with a lot of them, and I think it's really the responsibility of the executive or the commissioner or the division head to make more decisions than he or she does. And going back to something previously that Senator Croft alluded to, he said that the governor has a lot of naked power, you know, standing there all by himself. And a lot of your commissioners are too. And the nature of the political process the nature of the political process gives a lot of incentive for a person such as myself to try to spread the responsibility. And your officials in the past have spread that responsibility by asking a board or a commission for their advice on a subject. And I think that's principally the reason for the proliferation of these boards.
The two preceding speakers have failed to make some very important distinctions. You were talking about governing boards. There were 96 of them before statehood. All of them were autonomous, and that was deplorable. And that was done away with by the Constitution. There's only one limitation on advisory boards, and that's have you got the money to pay them. But input is a wonderful thing and should be encouraged. Citizen input in government. And there's no reason why there shouldn't be lots of advisory boards. It's the governing boards that are the evil. And that's what we've got to prevent, because then you have a government within a government. And the other thing is, I probably misunderstood Chauncey. He said the legislature set the policy for the state. I don't agree with you at all. Under our form of government, the governor also has an input in setting the policy of the state. It's a matter of compromise and mishmash back and forth between the two. But it certainly isn't an exclusive legislative policy to set the policy of the state of Alaska. Legislators are important, but they're not that damned important.
Yeah, Eric Wolfowitz, my name. I think this matter of advisory boards and commissions that we've seen proliferate, perhaps, in the last several years is a sort of an institutional foundering around for a solution in terms of the dynamic growth of the state, and I would say super dynamic growth. I think it's perfectly understandable that one would try a new institution, such as an advisory board. Some may work, some may not. I don't really see a pattern that I detect of any governor basing policy on a cause and effect basis from the commission. I think you've also seen, if you will, a lot more reliance on academic research in state government. Again, an attempt by the state government to in some way come to grips with the dynamic growth and the institute and the actual developments of the state, particularly in the last 5 years.
I think in my tongue, if I may comment that I pretty well am in agreement with what has just been said, to the extent that I'm not that much concerned that the utilization of the advisory boards for purposes of citizen input are bad. I think they're good. I think it's just a matter that there is a need for reassessment, and I would assume, since some of the boards are established by statute, a joint effort by the, perhaps led by the governor and the legislature from time to time, to assess the necessity of continuation of some of these forums. But that the basic notion of providing them for the purpose of citizen input, even if in fact because of their slowness they may not necessarily contribute that much to the development of policy for short-range objectives, I think they're very worthwhile.
It might be useful to have what they call a sunset law on boards and commissions, so that you have a mandatory review of a board or commission to determine and require the reenactment of the law founding that in the case of legislation.
We haven't had that problem in Alaska. I don't know of any archaic board that's maintaining itself in Alaska and accomplishing no useful purpose. Do you?
Yeah.
Which one?
Yukon Kaya.
Get rid of it then.
Anyone else out there?
Oh, they ought to have consumers representatives.
Yes, sir.
I'll never forget, you just spoke of the hairdressers' boards and all the different professional boards. We put in a bill once to put an average citizen on every board. In other words, someone that was divorced from the profession they were regulating. I got 400 wires in 24 hours protesting it, all from vested interests, the druggists, the hairdressers, cosmetologists, they call themselves, the veterinarians and everyone else. They wanted to run their own show. They didn't want the citizens to have anything to do with it at all. And that's not right.
That bill passed this year. It was Senate Bill 3.
Did you get it through?
Yeah. Not on the hairdresser. We did on it.
I took a horrible beating on that.
My name is Frank Barr. I was a member of the executive committee. Now I am one of those average citizens. I'd like to make some comments on several things that have been brought up here. I realize that I was a member on an important committee, but now my opinions are merely personal opinions. They have no force and probably no effect, but they might start a few thoughts. First, about parole boards. We must remember that at that time, 20 years ago, there was a feeling or an atmosphere beginning where people were feeling sorry for criminals. These criminals were people who had been brought up in ghettos or who were underprivileged, and the public had sympathy for them. They wanted to rehabilitate them. The idea was to send them to prison and rehabilitate them there, and then if they showed promise, of course, the parole board would let them out. Today, the pendulum has sort of swung the other way. We're becoming tired of harboring these criminals. The criminal element has been built up all out of proportion to the general population. There are prisons down south now, several varieties, all over the United States. Some of them are pretty tough, but there are some that have a country club atmosphere. And the people who are sent there are educated and entertained at the government expense. It could go on to the point where a person would commit a crime just in order to enter one of these exclusive clubs. The public's getting fed up. I, for one, every other day I see an account in the newspaper of some murder or multiple murder, and at the end of the news item it mentions that it was committed by a man who had been served so many years in such a prison and had been paroled. To my mind, the purpose of sending a man to prison is to eliminate him from society, to protect the people of the United States from his criminal activities. That is the primary objective. Now, if he could be rehabilitated, I'm all for it. I think rehabilitation should extend to the first offender. You have a chance, sir. He should be given a chance. He should be allowed out on parole if he shows promise. But he should be educated to the ways of society. But if a man, a second or third offender, a man who shows that he intends to be a criminal, or perhaps, well, if we know he's going to prey on society from then on, he should be eliminated. And that is to put him in there and keep him there. Keep him off the streets. Now, perhaps I'm a little tough, a little biased, but as I say, I keep seeing these accounts, and it has gotten to the point where in some of the larger cities, apartment houses have to hire their own guards. And we're going back to a medieval society where we have to erect walls around our residences even. The cause of this was the general public apathy and their sympathy for the criminal. Secondly, lenient judges, and then lenient parole boards. Now, John wants, or suggested at least, eliminating parole boards. Well, I'm not for that especially. I don't like to see changes made in the Constitution. This Constitution is a statement of policy, and it should have a long-range effect. The legislature acts as administrators for the state, and they could do these things. A parole board is what it is because of its makeup, the members on it, and the powers given it by the legislature. They can be tough or they can be lenient. But I sympathize with John's ideas on the parole board. They are one of the causes of turning loose all these criminals in our society. Another thing he mentioned, he says, what is an attorney general? Well, the average man doesn't know what an attorney general is. He suggests that an attorney general is probably some average lawyer who was put there because maybe he couldn't do anything else. Well, I have seen one or two that could answer that description, but that isn't what it should be. If he acts as capacity as an advisor to our chief executive in the state, he should be an unusual attorney, an extra intelligent man and experienced, because he is an advisor to our highest officer. Now, of course, naturally, he's not going to be an elected official and be like that. An elected attorney general would be one who may know very little law but is a good campaigner. And that was the reason the executive committee thought he should be appointed. Another thing about the lieutenant governor, we did not provide for a lieutenant governor because we thought that a strong executive should not be hampered by an assistant who was incompatible, either because he was an incompetent of the same party or because he was a member of the opposition party. Or perhaps he was just somebody who was incompetent, period. Now, I don't believe that a lieutenant governor or a secretary of state, if you wish, is necessarily a second-rate man or should be. It was stated that perhaps a man ran for lieutenant governor because he didn't feel that he was fitted to be governor, or because he felt he was second-rate. He wanted to be second to the governor. That's not necessarily so. When a man enters the field of politics, he usually enters in some lower office, and then he runs for the House, and then he goes to the Senate. And after the Senate, he might be appointed to some important position below the governor, who's unusually intelligent. He might be an attorney general. Who knows? And then, if he's attorney general, he generally has his eye on the governorship. Well, I would rather vote for him after he has taken all these steps through government, because he has learned about government all the way up. I would certainly rather vote for him than for somebody who has had no experience in government. The attorney general, it is true, as John said, he may not have much experience as a trial lawyer, and I have no idea one way or another about John's idea of making him purely a consultant for the governor. Of course, we have to have a good trial lawyer to take care of the cases for the state. But rather than change the Constitution, I believe that his office might perhaps be divided. He may have an assistant who is an expert trial lawyer, and have him handle those cases, while the Attorney General himself renders opinions for the governor. Now, I want to state that I'm giving you my opinions, and as I say, they don't have much force. I'm not a resident of the state now, and these are only opinions. But although I'm not a resident, I'm an Alaskan. You've heard the old saw about you can take the boy out of the country and so forth, and that is true. being an Alaskan is more of a state of mind than anything else, and I'll always be an Alaskan. If you ship a horse to Seattle, when it arrives in Seattle, it's still a horse. You can't. And you could change that horse into a cow easier than you could change me. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, sir. Are there any responses
to that? That business on rehabilitation of prisoners, it keeps coming up all the time. And, of course, the trend now is to throw everybody in jail and forget about them, and the hell with why they got there. They've missed once. If you miss once, it's okay. If you miss twice, you're doomed, right? Well, that in itself is ridiculous. Who's going to make these determinations? Now, we have a provision in the Constitution, and Armstrong put it in there, and he fought for it, and I thought it was good then, and I still think it's good, that our penal system is dedicated to the rehabilitation of prisoners. By that, we mean human beings. I think that's a damn worthy objective, and I don't think that prisoners are born prisoners. I don't think criminals are born criminals. I think it's a matter of environment, a happenstance, luck in life, a lot of different things that are beyond their control. I wouldn't change that provision, although I know it's under fire today. I think it's a very, very worthy purpose and one that should be encouraged. You can read about purse snatchings and devote all your time to it. It's usually a sign of advancing age. And there'll always be crime. But damn it, the people that commit crimes are human beings, and they're entitled to be treated as human beings with dignity. Most of them haven't had any opportunity. Most of them are drunks, if you really want to know about it. The statistics are made up of alcoholics, and we're not doing a hell of a lot about alcoholics.
So could we move on to another subject? There's a hell of a lot left here, and
yeah.
We could come back if we have time at the end. Over here, Mr. Bush.
Peter Blewett from Anchorage Community College. I've got a question that I'd like to direct. It's kind of oblique, and I was looking in the organization of the sessions, I couldn't find a place that dealt with the fourth estate, as Senator Croft termed it, i.e. the University of Alaska system. But I think part of the question is appropriate here. As you all know, there is a section in the Constitution which sets up the University of Alaska system as a separate constitutional entity. And I think this is somewhat unique in constitutions in the United States. It also, of course, called for the creation of a Board of Regents, which, of course, was appointed and is appointed by the governor, and which is supposed to direct and give policy to the university system. Now, this was done in 1956, and as you think back, you can recall that, of course, there was nothing really in the minds of very many people in the United States that anticipated the enormous growth of the community college concept as it was then getting off the ground. Today, it's a matter of record in most of the national magazines, that the community college concept, which I want you to consider, not in the sense of if there's an in-house struggle, of course, but thinking of it in terms of education at the local level. And this is, in fact, what the community college movement has focused on. And then keep in mind the broader perspective that we've heard in terms of the constitutional thrust, aiming at keeping power in the hands, as much as possible, of local and local groups and the people of Alaska. Now, the question, of course, is a difficult one, but it can be focused, I think, in terms of the role of the Board of Regents and the place of the university in the constitutional system. My question is this: has the Board of Regents been able to effectively govern the University of Alaska, as it was obviously intended to do, or at least to give policy direction to the University of Alaska? Secondly, in view of the enormous conflict and differences of opinion that have arisen between community college concerns and thrusts and traditional university concerns and thrusts, has the Board of Regents been able to cope with that? And if not, what kind of changes might be in order? I would like to suggest one, which is a nonpartisan change, that is that the Board of Regents obviously ought to be made an operating board, not a lay board. And perhaps this should be done in terms of a constitutional amendment.
What do you mean by an operating board?
Well, I mean a governing board in the sense of a day-to-day governing board where the members of the board actually serve as full-time and are paid as full-time managers of the system.
As opposed to a lay board
where they would meet on a quarterly basis and consider the things that kind of come up from time to time. Yeah,
with John Hambler.
I assume that this is a privileged body here, right? And that anything I say should not be held against me by the Board of Regents.
I'm in full agreement with you. I know
there's a separation of power.
Addressing it as a constitutional issue, it seems to me that the legislature, the constitutional provisions that set up the university, do not inhibit the legislature from adopting laws which establish a structure whereby the regents will exercise their authority. And it would be, let's say, supposing you took through your comments, some sort of surprising turn to me, because you started out by talking about the need of the community colleges to have independence, etc., and then you switched over and said maybe we ought to have a sort of a full-time Board of Regents as a governing body.
I don't think I used the word independence, but I know why you thought I did. My thrust was just that the concern of community colleges wasn't being considered by the regents.
This is a legislative matter,
not a constitutional matter.
Yeah, I think you can resolve it. Depending on how you want to resolve it. I mean, there's nothing that would stop the legislature in the Constitution from establishing full-time regents if they wanted to. There's nothing in the Constitution that would prohibit the legislature from providing for independent
boards for specific institutions like community colleges to operate within the general umbrella of the region. It seems to me what the Constitution says, and correctly so to me, is that higher education should be managed under some sort of unifying principle. The very minimum, you need to have a board of regents that can exercise a refereeing authority in order to resolve disputes, jurisdictional issues between the various institutions of higher education. Otherwise, you can get this from any one campus, the community college, competing against a senior college by establishing the same course and curriculum under, if you allow, merely total independence. But you do have to have regents, and I think that there is a wide allowance to the legislature to determine how that authority is going to be exercised. Does that respond, Peter?
Not precisely, because my question was really, has the Board of Regents been able to effectively govern?
Well, they aren't. I don't think the way it's presently set up, maybe it's implied in your question, but you cannot govern with a part-time board any more than a part-time fish and game board manages the Department of Fish and Game. The management operates through an executive authority. I might add, I think it would be a disaster for fish and game to have a full-time board and get rid of that executive officer. You don't want to have the executive authority exercised by a committee.
No, but go back to the reason. The reason for the provision in the Constitution about the university is politeness and tradition. That's all it was. There was no particular reason. And it could very well have been eliminated from the Constitution. They perpetuated an existing board. That's all they did, and they did it because of traditions and because the university wanted it, and they very politely gave them that. But you know what they did? As soon as the Constitution was adopted, they interpreted it as that they were no longer under state control. For example, in procurement, university never followed the procurement policies of the state. They never followed the salary scales of the state. They did just what the hell they wanted to do. And they are still a part of the state of Alaska. And a lot of the troubles that you've had have been because of they ignored the Constitution and they didn't fit into the entire picture. For some reason or other, they thought they were a little gods. And in fact, they didn't do a very good job in running the university either. They hired poor managers, and they I thought they.
Pick up this on the same subject.
But it isn't a constitutional problem at all.
Let's keep this one brief.
Okay. I happen to be a graduate of the university too, 29, and I had something to do with getting this in there. But the part of the thing. It says the University of Alaska is hereby established as a state university and constituted a body corporate. It shall have title to all real and personal property now or hereafter set aside for or conveyed to it. Its property shall be administered and disposed of according to law. Now, that was just to protect the university. We were here on the campus, and we appreciated that. And the university had really appreciated this clause in the Constitution.
Anybody else out there have something?
Yes, I'd like to say that. I don't have to introduce myself, do I? This isn't done. Is it still on, this? Well, I'm Catherine Nordale, and I was a delegate. This it very clearly says that the regents shall, in accordance with law, formulate policy and appoint the president of the university, and he's the executive officer of the board. Now, I don't see that it's necessarily the Board of Regents that is upsetting your community college thing. They're setting the policy, and they appoint their executive officer, and then he does the work. And of course, as far as the system is concerned, this was a land-grant school when we were a territory. And naturally, they had a Board of Regents. which all land grant schools do. Why should ours be different?
That's the reason for my question, because obviously the board is supposed to formulate policy, as you quoted. And it's a fact, it's a matter of record, that the Board of Regents has almost not given any attention at all to community college policy in the state. And it's a matter of record that community colleges constitute the enormous majority of students and educational concern in this state at this moment. And my concern, my question was raised because I don't think the board is doing what you just quoted they're supposed to be doing.
I'm not in a position to say that we like community colleges.
I don't think there should be anything in the Constitution about community colleges.
No, I don't either.
Well, then what are we talking about here?
We're talking about appointing, about having a board that is not a lay board. And I appreciate John Hadlock's comment, because I think that's the answer.
Andy Worley.
Yeah, you know, structurally, there's the language in the Constitution, I think, is ideal. The university is run by a Board of Regents. You know, they don't run it, they set the policy. You know, it'd be a...
Subject to law.
Yeah, subject to law. It'd be a fiasco to have a board run something. You know, be running by committee.
You're dodging my question. How do you feel about a full-time board?
I think it'd be ridiculous. I think that the appropriate mechanism is there. They run it. They spend as much time as necessary. They generally run it as a corporation is run by a board of directors. The board appoints or in some way obtains the president and so forth. They have some voice over matters, but it's generally limited to the policy. But your problem with the community college is largely a financial one. From the situation right now, you can't sink enough money into the University of Alaska to remedy all the problems. You know, there's every village, every community in the state of Alaska wants a community college, and simply we just don't have enough money to put one in every community.
It's a motherhood issue on top of that. Everybody loves community colleges, but
I think there's another point there too. We have on our Board of Regents a lot of capable men and
women.
Yes, excuse me. And it says they appoint the president, and he shall be the executive officer of the board. And I think that's the answer right there.
Are there any other issues having to do with the whole sweep of the executive branch that we discussed?
I don't. It's Wolforth again. This I don't know if I can really pinpoint an issue, but a perception that I have, and I began to think about it during John Borbridge's speech. I think we've seen here this morning, to some extent, a sort of a feeling, and obviously we're at a constitutional convention review, that the language of the Constitution is a remedy to the problem. I think the last speaker probably emphasized that more than anyone else. We're getting, it seems to me, in the last several years, general elections, more and more substantive amendments. Real amendments to our state constitution. The one that's up now, that's properly budget and finance. Hopefully there will be some participants this afternoon, is of course one of extreme importance, and that is the establishment of the permanent fund, which I think has real institutional, legislative, and executive significance, because I happen to feel that budget making and finance is of perhaps paramount importance in many respects. It surprised me a little, John, when you said that the Constitutional Convention didn't realize that the finance committees would be as important as they are. They should have, because they always are.
It was their mistake.
In every legislature, a time out of mind. But I do see a tendency, maybe again, with dynamic change in state government, dynamic changes in Alaska, to wonder whether or not the constitutional process might be the solution. Increasingly, the permanent fund, I think, perhaps should be looked at, and if you're willing to discuss it from that basis, a major institutional change in the offing that differs at least from the very clear perception that the framers had of how state government, state finances were going to be managed.
Are you advocating a constitutional amendment with regard to the permanent fund?
It's on the ballot.
Do you think it's a good idea?
I'm not.
I like to.
If you're a spirit of academia, I'm trying not to come down on either side of it. But just opposed to play.
Like war.
There are three propositions on the ballot that have something to do with executive authority, and that should be addressed somewhere in this convention. One, Mr. Croft mentioned, is this sort of slipped in as a sort of a restatement of the, described as something like a restatement of the relationship between the executive and the legislative branch on the disposal of land. Now, I'll admit I've got my biases, and I think that it's a power grab by the legislature to inappropriately take over a piece of the executive authority in the disposition of land, and I think that one of the results would be to politicize the land disposal process, which has enough problems as it is with the political aspect. The second issue, of course, the unicameralism as an advisory vote is on, and I think we really ought to take a serious look at unicameralism and all the ballot proposition does and say,
let's take a look at it.
And I think there should be an extensive study of the effect, and it will obviously has ramifications for the relationship between executive and legislative power. It would mean a considerably more powerful legislature vis-a-vis executive authority that now exists, and that has ramifications which may be good or bad. Thirdly, is this the question of the dedicated or permanent fund. That has enormous implications for the strong central form of government, because if we have a fund, and I've heard it, Eric and others describe the importance of having this as an independent fund, independently managed. And what my suggestion on that is, particularly considering the magnitude of the dollars involved, that you are dividing the executive branch of government, and you are going to have another government, another executive branch, which is going to be the manager accountable to who, I ask, of that enormous dedicated fund, who will have the a special power of the purse to disperse the benefits of that fund on what standards, I ask, and who are going to be the ultimate beneficiaries of that kind of an appropriation process, particularly when that appropriation process is dependent upon the recipient being in a profit-making mode. So I ought to get some of the dedicated fund buffs moving.
All right, if I may, just to... not to get into colloquy, but the decision on management, John, in all fairness, has yet to be made and will be made by the legislature. So the legislature, at some near point, January, or more likely May or June, will come to a determination as to how the fund will be managed. Now, one can perceive now it should be managed in a given way, and there's a right way of doing it, but it is a legislative question.
Well, their track record is dismal when it comes to managing the funds of the state.
Walt Parker has something further.
I think the important question, which John started to approach, is whether the management of the permanent fund, and I think the management structure is far more important than the size of the fund and always will be, because it'll probably be with us for a long, long time. It was whether you're going to spell out the management structure in the Constitution or whether you are going to leave it in the statutes and leave it to the legislature. Because, of course, what one legislature does, the next one can undo. Once you put it in the Constitution, it does acquire some enduring quality. And to me, why, until we really grope with this question and start to come up with some answers to it on which there is consensus, we should not proceed too rapidly with the whole concept of the permanent fund.
John Bordrich, do you have any thoughts on this? It alludes to some comments you made in your presentation.
Yes, I think the concern I feel again is not so much addressed to the proposition we have crystallized our thinking here and therefore can't change it, but rather there's a partial premise here that the revenue that we can anticipate receiving once the oil is on stream is going to far exceed that which we might be able to prudently use for the management of our state government. But again, I'm not altogether certain that we have consciously evaluated what the full spectrum of concerns are that we have as a state. As I'd reiterated before, I feel very much concerned that we must be careful about slipping into a situation where we become so bottom-line oriented that we have to view the prudent use of the fund, once we define this, as being that use which assures some kind of a return through a profit orientation. And as I'd indicated, in fact, there are conditions, there are needs, pressing needs in the state concerning which we had addressed ourselves to in the past as being unable to meet them simply because we just didn't have the financial resources to do so. I think the assurance of an equal quality education, for example, to all of the citizens of the state is certainly a basic proposition that we all endorse, except at the point that we start to price it out, and then we somewhat back away, and the result is we actually don't establish a clear policy wherein we say we will try by this certain time to achieve this level of delivery of services, whether we're talking about education, we're talking about medicine, or opportunities in housing, or just the plain, simple, everyday privilege we have of drinking pure water. I'm not suggesting that the money that can be prudently used and considered for
health, public health. I'm sure Eric didn't mean by prudent investment a 6.5% return. One of the greatest things that happened to this state is that we spent our money for people rather than for a return on investment. And this is, I think, is what you're trying to say. And we better continue it, too. And if we don't, we're falling down on our responsibilities to our fellow men. This isn't a banker's problem, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. You know, in my opinion, the real issue for the permanent fund is not how we're going to manage it or how we're going to utilize it, but whether or not we should have it. You know, in foreign countries, you know, the Arab countries, and so forth, this is regard. You know, developing a permanent fund is sort of like nationalization or participation in the profits. You know, the real question would should be whether or not this is an appropriate goal for state government, or an appropriate action by state government to take a portion of the tax, use some of it, and save some of it. In my opinion, the role of government should be to tax industry or people or whatever to provide essential services. But what we're doing here is we're taxing the industry, using some of it for ongoing services, and putting some of it in the bank for future services.
Are we taxing them, or are we taking our share of the resources there?
Okay, I think strictly speaking, it's not a tax, it's a royalty, but it's similar. You know, you're taking a portion of the oil. You can either take a portion of it, you can tax it. Of a resource. But, you know, to me, it's very similar. It'd be no difference between government doing that and, say, taking part of my tax dollars that I pay every year to the state, putting some of it in the bank and using some of it to pay ongoing services.
Sounds to me like someone read Benjamin Franklin's almanac and got all screwed up.
We have a comment out here.
You know,
the bill, to use the microphone, Mr. Chairman, that is.
Still getting back to this seminar, whether the permanent fund or not is a separate question, but the relationship of the fund to the Constitution and through the Constitution to the governor and the legislature still needs a great deal of discussion, which hasn't been done yet.
You elect a new legislature or a new governor if they don't know how to manage the funds of the state. Just
again,
that simple.
Yes, sir. Well, I agree with the last comment wholeheartedly. I happen to favor the permanent fund wholeheartedly, but I do think it needs real analysis, because we're talking about carving out of, eventually, with legislative permission and at their direction, carving away from the public fisc, if you will, 25% of royalties and mineral income. Now, it does create, it seems to me, something to examine. We talked about the fourth estate or the fourth branch of government, the University of Alaska, if indeed it be that. At some point, the public process has to deal, it seems to me, with the fifth potential estate, the managers of the fund, should the legislature decide that on that sort of configuration for managing it. They may decide to make all the managers the entire legislature. It's not beyond the realm of possibility. That's really my point.
I think if I might comment, Tom, I think part of the concern I feel is I agree that we ought to approach this in principle out there to be such a fund established and to look at the constitutional relationship. But the reason that some parts of the Alaska population has to view it in terms of use is simply because there are, in fact, needs that have not been met today, and we all know that this exists. And therefore, one of the concerns I'm expressing might well have been met if the emphasis of state government, and I appreciate the pragmatic circumstances in which pressures persist, but if the emphasis had been on the long-range planning, or if it were to take effect, I admit initially, without very much in the way of a dramatic interest by the electorate, but I think the electorate could be at least brought to the point through a persistent effort by the executive where long-range implications of just where we are going would assume more importance. I think in part we have a sense that the wise thing to do is to set aside some of this fund. I think a wise thing to do is to determine just where we're going to go after the fund starts coming in. And I think these, what we seem to be saying in part, and I'm not arguing against the fund, is simply that let's get the fund and let's make a determination of how we're going to use it. And once you get the fund pretty well rolling along and a momentum established for getting it, then the real battle becomes, instead of long-range objectives, who's going to get on there and how are we going to use this money? It becomes a target in effect, and so those of us looking at it from the outside will say to ourselves, and others of you have articulated this very well, we've got to develop an approach to the governor, the executive, we've got to develop one to the legislature, and we certainly have to develop one to the permanent fund. And I would, I very much agree that the implications of how it is going to relate to the existing institutions is an all-important one.
This is an extremely important issue worth pursuing. I don't want to monopolize the very end if there's some other pressing questions people have. The significance of this has just been articulated. It represents a major institutional innovation having a direct effect on the strong executive concept.
You ought to take the course in sensible spending.
I imagine it will be taken up, as John just mentioned, in the finance committee this afternoon.
Well, with respect to this, then I'd like to direct a question at the group, the panelists. Could the permanent fund, the thrust for the permanent fund, be seen as the public's reaction to the failure on the part of the governor's office, that is, to set up anything like a coherent and consistent planning operation?
Yeah, I think the public's reaction to the permanent fund is a direct result of the legislatures and the executives' ability to spend money, specifically the $900 million. You know, we have, in effect, I think we've computed sometime in March of this year, the $900 million was gone, and people look around them and they say, "Well, what did we get for the $900 million?" And you know, you have to look pretty hard to see anything. And they don't want that to happen to the revenues from the oil and gas that'll be coming in tremendous quantities. And
I think you know where that went, don't you?
I know where it went.
I appreciate the spending of it too. I think it improved the quality of life in Alaska.
What about the failure of the part of the governor's offices, the various governors, to create that kind of long-range plan? That's the second part of my question.
Well, they tried it. They got a bunch of bankers, and would they lose $500 million in 3 months or something like that? And then they all dipped into it and took their percentage, and it was ridiculous. If you spend it on necessary needs to improve the human race in Alaska, that's the best investment you can make.
Mr. Warwick seems to be against the permanent fund, and I'm just curious as to how he handles his personal finances. If he receive an unexpected $1,000 or two, would he put part of it aside for a rainy day, which is customary, or would he bring his standard of living up to the point to where he would spend it right away? Now,
that's a good question. I differentiate the role of an individual and the role of government. That's,
I can see.
That's my philosophy. You know, my philosophy is the role of an individual is to try to accumulate, you know, to build and so forth, but that's not the role of government. The role of government should be very simple. It should be to tax and to provide the essential services, not to put away for a rainy day.
Did you ever heard of anybody
but you use the word
went down in history because he had a great big tin can full of money when he was leader of the state?
But Mr. Warwick, you used the you said to provide for essential services. It's a human failing that these services become more essential as you become used to them, and the more a man makes, the more services are essential to him. And that's the same way with government. We have lots of conveniences and services here that we couldn't imagine a while back, and they're appreciated and they're useful, but there's no end to it if you have no end to the income. And now I'm very well acquainted with the history of the town of Fairbanks, and it has been a series of booms and busts, and real busts, I mean down low. Right now, especially if there isn't a gas line built, we're just on the tail end of a boom here now. And I wonder what it will be like in 10 years. I don't know. I can't see into the future. Maybe okay. There are other industries we can build up, tourism and all sorts of things. But if it goes according to past history, it'll be a bust. And this could be statewide. See, I'm an old-timer. This could be statewide also, to some extent. I'm an optimist. I don't believe it's ever be as bad as it has in the past. But I think we should provide for the future and put a little away. Now, that's just an opinion. But I think it's a basic principle that you should put something aside for a rainy day.
I want to make one quick response to that. Is that this kind of putting away for a rainy day is it's looking at a 50-year span or whatever, 30 to 50 years. And the lesson of history is, at least as far as material wealth, talk about quality of life and some other aspects, but as far as material wealth goes, the people who you are saving up for, who are by and large, most of whom are not born yet, are going to be on their own far more wealthy in terms of access to material wealth than we are today. That's the way it is today. We're far better off in terms of access to material goods than our forefathers were 30, 40, 50 years ago.
No one here is advocating the spending of every damn dollar that we take in, and certainly a sensible person would have some reserves to meet contingencies similar to our unemployment fund and things like that that we've had for years and will continue. But the object is, it doesn't do you any good in a tin can. The money should be prudently, I hate that word prudent, it should be sensibly spent to improve the life of the people that live there.
Instead of a tin can, you have a permanent income.
Yeah, but you should have bought real estate instead. You can make a lot more money.
Just a short comment. Recently, it was a year ago, when the legislature was considering a permanent fund, I heard a story on, it was on the news, about a woman who had who was found in her house. She had died of starvation. And they started looking into her assets, and they found that she had over $1 million in a safety deposit box. And that, you know, you can relate that situation very well to the state of Alaska. Well, you can. You need to travel around the state to see it.
This happened because of her state of mind, but the average state of mind is expensive.
I agree. It happened because of her state of mind. But the state of mind of the citizens of Alaska at this point is very similar. They look, you know, the majority of them look around up here in Fairbanks and in Anchorage, you know, where you're fluent, and you see that, you see the legislature spending that money regardless of what, and I say the legislature because they appropriate, the executive branch is equally as guilty. They see the people in Juneau spending the money on virtually everything. But if you look around in some of the other areas, the people aren't quite as affluent, as I'm sure the gentleman at the end of the table can attest. And what we're doing is we are, in a sense, saving for people down the road who are not going to need it as much as the people right now need it.
You know, I want to pay a compliment to the Native people. The first investments they made were in the betterment of their people in education and health and things like that, and that's to your eternal credit. I haven't seen these people running around in Cadillacs or doing any of the stupid things that a lot of wise people thought you were going to do. You made sensible, decent investments, and I hope you continue.
John Havelock, you have the last word on the subject for now.
I just wanted to point out that on this thing that we're talking about, an amendment to the Constitution, the change, not an addition, the change, and it will, for some purposes, repeal a very fine provision that you all provided for, which prohibits dedicated funds. And the purpose of that prohibition was to avoid tying the hands of legislatures as to the purpose for which funds would be expended. Even adopting the rainy day principle, there is nothing in the law now which prohibits the legislature from appropriating annually capital to a development bank. You could do that now. You could set up this fund now. What this constitutional proposal proposes to do is to fix it so the legislature has no control. There is no the flexibility which the legislature is supposed to have in determining a wide range of social and private needs is curtailed by this amendment, which demands that a certain proportion, regardless of state needs, this varies from year to year, that certain proportion goes to this use, which is dedicated to a profit-making activity, and therefore must be will be invested to people who will spend it. It's not really, if you give money to a bank, it doesn't, it may be from some perspective putting it away, but from the perspective of the bank, it is money that they then lend out and becomes a part of your of an economy, somebody's economy. And
who's going to pick those elite managers?
I volunteer.
Yeah, I'd love to be a government. One day, government within a government.
It's ridiculous. I'm sure some articulate rebuttals to John's articulate argument, but we've got to wrap this up, and hopefully this subject will be taken up further in the afternoon session, discussion of finances. And I assume it will be. I think that in a somewhat orderly fashion, the panel's development of the subject has been very, very good. We went from sort of the specifics and mechanics of the constitutional article and general celebration of the strong executive concept, which there seemed to be consensus that's wonderful. Then a statement that some parts of the article could use some possible renovation, but the only one that there seems to be agreement that does deserve that kind of look has to do with the way the lieutenant governor is selected. Then we moved into the more informal developments, which have really affected the strong executive concept, with some difference in perspective as to whether we're talking about an erosion of the powers of the governor or a strengthening of the powers of the legislature, which is also an intent of the Constitution. And then the development of new mechanisms such as the permanent fund, where most of our latter comments focus, which are themselves going to have major implications for both the power of the executive and the legislature over time. So there has been some order here, and to me, I found it very interesting. I want to thank each of the members of the panel for their contributions and for the audience and his participation. Thank you very much.